You are listening to CEO Perspectives, a podcast by the Conference Board.
Welcome to this episode of CEO Perspectives, a signature webcast and podcast series by the Conference Board. CEO Perspectives are conversations that take an objective, nonpartisan look at a range of timely topics. To help make sense of these topics, we'll sit down with experts and do what we do best at the Conference Board, provide insights for what's ahead. I'm Steve Odlin, the CEO of the Conference Board and the host of this series. While the world's attention has been on the war in Ukraine, the friendly relationship between Russia and China has prompted widespread speculation as to what's going to happen next. Today, we'll discuss China and Russia's past and present relationship, as well as the related hot button issue of Taiwan. Will China invade the island territory? And what would that mean for Taiwan? And of course, all the commercial ramifications like semiconductor production. Joining me today is Dr. Lori Esposito Murray. Lori is the president of the Committee for Economic Development, which is the public policy center of the Conference Board. And Lori is a renowned international relations expert. Lori, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Steve. It really is a privilege to be here with you today.
Yeah. So, Lori, you know, maybe we should just start by going back a little bit in history and just describing how China and Russia have, you know, Russia and USSR in its various forms have been friends and foes over time.
Steve, that's an excellent starting point, because I think understanding the historical relationship between Russia and China will actually help us understand where we are today, the significance of it, but also foreshadow where we may be heading to in the future with this, with the relationship. And so starting at the beginning in 1949, when Mao Zedong, the communist leader of the insurgency, the civil war, declared victory, announced the People's Republic of China, the relationship with Russia was very close, and it was a mentorship relationship. He very much admired Stalin. He very much admired the Soviet system. And actually his first visit overseas was, of course, to Russia, and which culminated in the Sino-Soviet Treaty of Friendship, which was supposed to be a 30-year treaty of friendship, but only lasted 10 years. But he really wanted a formal alliance. He got the formal alliance with Stalin, and it was a military relationship, mostly helping this new nascent communist nation, important communist nation, and a big symbol to the communist countries and the rest of the third world, so to speak, that communism was on the move, and a big hit to the United States in terms of who lost China after having to deal with the problems that we were dealing with Soviet incursion into Eastern Europe after World War II. And of course, this happens in 1949, when we were establishing NATO to actually deal with Soviet incursions into the Eastern European countries, and taking over control of those governments. And then you have the collapse of the nationalists in China and the rise of Mao Zedong. So a relationship based on between the two new communist nations, or a new friendship based with China and military, economic, but mostly military. And you see this throughout the 50s. The Soviet Union really helped China develop its nuclear weapons, as well as its reestablish its conventional military as well. A split happens in 1960, and I think what happens in the 50s is actually reflected in Nikita Khrushchev's quote in his diaries, where he said, you might say that China is both close to us and far from us. It's close in that it's our next door neighbor and shares a long border with our country. At the same time, China is far away, and the Chinese have little in common with our people. And I think that really does symbolize the strains and the conflict that actually made their way into the relationship, particularly after Stalin dies in 1953, who had a mentorship relationship with Mao Zedong. And so you see a battle for ideological leadership influenced in the third world, in the non-aligned countries. There's a battle of which communist power is actually more Russia or China, is closer to understanding the cultures of those countries. The second was the collaboration on military issues really fell apart. They started clashing on the border, mostly. It was this border that caused real problems, and in 1969 almost turned into a hot, very hot war between now the two nuclear powers. And then there was a big split ideologically on economic issues, and you have Mao Zedong doing his Great Leap Forward and really turning away from Soviet economic policy and focusing on an intensive campaign to reorganize its population in China. So that causes a major split, and this becomes an opening for Henry Kissinger and the new president, new administration, President Nixon and Henry Kissinger, trying to solve the conflict in Vietnam. Russia and China are actually at odds on how the policy for North Vietnam. And Kissinger moves in and actually realizes the only way the U.S. is going to get out of Vietnam and also looking at a new world order going forward is to reestablish a relationship with China. And so after years of isolation, we actually have an opening to China during the Kissinger administration. And that actually served to divide even further Russia and China from each other as they both tried to establish their own relationships with the US in this triangular period of relationships. And then basically what you see happen with Gorbachev is a new effort to realign China and Russia together as the Soviet Union is going through this major reform period. And it took years, several years, but it culminates in his summit with Deng Xiaoping, which actually opens this new era of slowly building better relations with then, you know, as they're not totally focused on each other because China's dealing with Tiananmen Square. The Soviet Union is collapsing, but relations gradually improve with the new democratic Russia. And the major turning point, though, is 2014. And in 2014, after Putin annexes Crimea, after Russia annexes Crimea, China really moves in and establishes a much closer trading relationship, economic relationship, and political relationship, and friendship between Putin and Xi.
Yeah, and you know, so it sounds like the post-World War II era could be described as the enemy of my enemy is my friend. I mean, coming out of World War II, where Russia was faced with Germany and China was faced with Japan, who in turn were allies with each other, they kind of came together. And then the ideology, of course, made them come together. But the world history didn't start in 1949. And so, you know, you have to go back a long time as Chinese leaders keep reminding the West, you know, thousands and thousands of years and empires. And the Chinese, you know, they live in the same neighborhood. They've been next door neighbors for a long time, but the Chinese society and, you know, economic and military domination going back millennia were far in advance of the Russians and or anyone in that region. And they kind of cling to that, you know, ancient view that the, you know, Chinese state really should be number one. And that, you know, that you've reminded us before that kind of overrides and provides a backdrop to the current history.
Right. And I think when I was saying that to understand where this may be going is that the relationship between Stalin and Mao was one of Stalin being the mentor and the Soviet Union being the established communist power and a real power. Because that was 1949, you're talking about 1918 when the revolution happened. So you're at the nascent peace part of the revolution in China. But that switches, and that's what's switched now. Now China is the major economy in the world, and Russia is the 11th economy in the world, very much dependent on one sector, the energy sector, for its economic prowess. And what you see is right now there is a strategic alignment it is in terms of really changing the world order, and particularly, as you said, the enemy of my enemy is my enemy. The U.S. is the enemy here, U.S. global power, realigning the world order. They very much have that in common. They also have a friendship. I think they very much understand each other and have very similar attitudes towards...
The two individuals, President Xi and President Putin, yeah.
But what's interesting now is that the tables have actually turned, and that the tension that may develop going forward, particularly if these sanctions, these very severe sanctions continue, is that Russia is going to be far more dependent on China for its economic viability and its future, which puts Russia in a very much a secondary position in that relationship, which makes you question how long can an imbalanced relationship between two countries that actually see themselves as empires. You know, if you have that much of an imbalance in the relationship as you did when the Soviet Union was the powerful relationship and it caused tensions, the tables are turned, but it's a relationship not between equals, and you could see tensions building over the long term.
Yeah, and you know, you also have to point out the demographic difference. I mean, China has nearly 10 times as many people as the Soviet Union, and quite a bit bigger economy than I said Soviet Union, but meaning Russia today. So it's a big difference. Let's go back and just really briefly touch on the history of the island of Formosa, because it now is Taiwan, but the island of Formosa has been, you know, a Dutch colony, a Portuguese colony, a Spanish colony. I mean, it has been, you know, at the crossroads and part and of many different, empires over time. Talk about its relationship with China.
So moving into more recent history, since 1895, Japan had actually controlled Formosa, Taiwan. And it was only at the end of the war in 1945 that China actually got control of the island of Taiwan.
And so is that the first time in history that that's been the case?
For the most part, yes. Yes.
Yeah. I think there were some periods in the 1700s, but this is an important point, because China keeps saying that they have an ancient right to Taiwan, but in fact, history doesn't support that, does it?
Right. There was a period during the Qing dynasty, but for the most part, this has not been an island that has historically been a part of China. And what's fascinating is that, again, back to the Civil War and Chiang Kai-shek and the Nationalist Party, when Mao Zedong won that Civil War, when the communists won that Civil War, the Nationalist Chinese, the Republic of China, flee to Taiwan. And they flee with 2 million people. And that's really what became the the major population of Taiwan. So it was the Chinese that were fleeing, the nationalist Chinese who were fleeing, who actually then inhabit the island of Taiwan.
Right. So this is really, I think this is a really important point. And because before that, it was largely, sparsely populated, mostly with indigenous peoples, and it had exchanged hands over time. So this is a relatively new thing. Then finally, you've got to describe the history of the sort of the one China policy, both from the view of China, but also from the view of Western nations.
Okay, so the one China policy was a very, very important policy in terms of the opening of Taiwan, opening of China. The Nixon administration coming in, really realigning, very forward thinking, trying to get out of this lockhold of the Cold War relationships, trying to solve geostrategic problems, particularly for us, the Vietnam War, new strategy, have a opening to China. And part of that was the ambiguity over the role of Taiwan, since we had supported even during World War II, the Nationalist Party, Chiang Kai-shek in China and then in Taiwan for, and that was, we were holding on to Taiwan and the Nationalist Chinese actually being, the Republic of China actually being the one China. So how do you get over that stumbling block in terms of your opening of a relationship with the mainland of China? It becomes the one China policy. And so there was deliberate ambiguity built into it. The US and China each had their own definition, maintained their own definition of what was the one China. Was that the Republic of China or the People's Republic of China? The US said it acknowledged the Chinese position that there is but one China and that Taiwan is part of China. But in that phrase, acknowledging the Chinese position was not accepting the Chinese position. And we maintain the ambiguity that we could interpret the one China policy as being the Republic of China on the island of Taiwan as the one China.
And it's important, the history is important here too, because post 1949, it was actually Taiwan that was the member of the United Nations. And it was following the Nixon administration's reopening of relationships with mainland China, or so-called Red China in those days, that then switched the membership at the UN from Taiwan to mainland China, which is probably been forgotten by a lot of people. But this history is really important.
Right. And so what happens in 1971 is that Taiwan had held that seat, the China seat. And in 1971, the UN passes a resolution that with our agreement to recognize mainland China as the People's Republic of China as the representative of China. And Taiwan is actually removed from the UN. So it is not a country. It is not a country recognized by the UN. It does have diplomatic relations with about 15 countries. It actually is in a number of regional associations because it's of its important role in the economy. About 40 of them, the most important, of course, is the WTO and a couple of the Asian organizations. But China, the People's Republic of China, has really worked very hard to make sure that there are costs to any country that wants to have diplomatic relations with Taiwan.
But this whole swap is as recent as the 1970s, and China's recognition, and then later they joined China, mainland China joined the WTO. So all of this is relatively recent, and you know, we have to put that into context. So we've talked about the history of the relationship between China and Taiwan, Russia and China, and we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back and talk about the recent agreements. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
As war rages in Ukraine, the Conference Board is closely monitoring the situation and producing timely and relevant content on a daily basis that will help the business community navigate this global geopolitical unrest. What will the impact be on oil prices, food prices, our supply chain, and what about cybersecurity? How will this conflict impact the way your organization does business around the world, and how will you communicate this crisis to customers and employees? We're gathering the very latest content on our website. Just head to conference-board.org and find trusted insights to help you and your team lead with confidence.
Welcome back to CEO Perspectives. I'm your host, Steve Odlin, the CEO of the Conference Board, and I'm joined today by Dr. Lori Esposito-Murray, who is the president of the Committee for Economic Development, the Public Policy Center of the Conference Board. Okay, so Lori, we've talked about the history. Now we've got to come back to 2022. So here we are. The Olympics are going on or planned to happen in China. And in February, there is now what I think will be called an historic meeting between the presidents of Russia and China. What went on in that meeting and what were the agreements?
The meeting was really significant, Steve. And as you said, it has historic significance, not only real-time significance for the period we are going through now since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but Xi and Putin meet. And just to put this in context, it has been several months that the U.S. has been sharing intelligence about the Russian buildup on the Ukrainian border, and that we believe that Russia is going to invade Ukraine. And we have started very intensive diplomatic efforts since November with top cabinet officials talking to allies, partners, as well as major powers about our concerns about what is happening on the border of Ukraine and Russia's intentions. Putin goes to China right before the Olympics for the opening of the Olympics, and he is the only major leader who actually attends the Olympics, which is very important to Xi Jinping, since the particularly the Western powers were not sending diplomatic representation to the opening to the Olympics ceremonies themselves because of human rights concerns about what was happening with the Uyghurs. He shows up. Putin shows up. They release a very long friendship statement. This is their biannual friendship statement. And it includes, it demonstrates the strategic alignment of both Russia and China. They, and really lays the groundwork for the arguments for the invasion of Ukraine. There was joint opposition to NATO expansion in Europe, opposition to the U.S. role and leadership in Asia in terms of the Quad and the agreement we had with Australia in terms of our the submarine agreement. And it was a very explicit endorsement of Russia's concerns about security in Europe. I mean, everything you're hearing from the Chinese now as well. And it was an explicit endorsement of by Russia of China's position in Taiwan. And so and it was called a limitless friendship, limitless relationship. And so it codified the strategic relationship in a very detailed way and a very expansive way. It was almost like signing it in blood by both parties. That was on the political, the geopolitical side. On the economic side, what, you know, particularly in retrospect, although it was a bit real time, what happens with sanctions is that they become viable usually 30 days after they're put in place, because you have to implement the sanctions, get the regulations up. And so everything is accepted up to that point as being prior to sanctions, it's grandfathered. Well, at this meeting, Putin did all of the basically preparing for the sanctions work that he needed to do. There was a $117 billion agreement that on oil and gas and plans for the second major pipeline that they were going to hopefully implement the next several years. There was a $20 billion coal contract. There was a China lifted the restrictions on wheat imports from Russia, which they had on there for health reasons because they thought the wheat was damaged by disease, and they lifted those constraints. Very much, you know, in retrospect, you look back on it, and they were very much, it looks like they were very much anticipating the sanctions that would happen or, you know, to Russia. And Russia's finding a new outlet for its oil and gas. Expanding that, increasing the levels of oil and gas relationship, selling the coal, and we now see a coal embargo in Europe, and also in terms of food and wheat, barley, filling that gap as well.
And there was an implicit agreement that China would not, I guess, go after Russia or oppose Russia's actions in Ukraine. And in exchange, implicitly, that, you know, Taiwan was China's sphere of influence and the that Russia would not engage in that. And then you saw the subsequent votes in the UN. So talk about, so there was a lot that was implicit. Describe that, and then describe what was explicit, what was formalized.
Well, you know, it's interesting because in a way, most of the arguments that are being made now by the Chinese to support that support Russia's invasion of Ukraine were explicit. I mean, it was an explicit criticism of NATO expansion, which is the fundamental reason that Putin has said he's doing this. For it's existential for Russia. It's an existential problem. That was all, pretty much embraced. That was embraced by the Chinese. China's position on Taiwan was embraced. So you really saw, you know, the and this wasn't new. I mean, it wasn't as if China had a different position on NATO and its relationship with Russia. As a matter of fact, China was very much focused on NATO expansion because in the every decade, NATO renews, updates its strategic objectives, its strategic plan. And NATO has been very transparent that what they were going to look at this meeting that's coming up soon, their next meeting that's coming up soon, to look at this, you know, to actually formalize the strategic objectives, China was at the forefront of that, how to deal with the China threat. And so, you know, NATO was pretty much a problem that was shared by both. It wasn't just a generous concern on the part of the Chinese.
So was there, is there an explicit agreement, public or private, that we're aware of, that, you know, that Russia will support a China invasion of Taiwan?
No, there's not an explicit agreement. There is an explicit agreement of Russia very much embracing China's definition of the One China policy.
The One China policy. Okay. So now, you know, Russia had used the NATO, you know, has said he's being surrounded by NATO and so-called NATO aggressiveness to justify going into Ukraine and, you know, the historical relationship. And now you're starting to hear some of the same language, whether it's just, you know, accidental or whether it's deliberate, but the same language being used by China against Taiwan. So a lot of people interpret that to mean that China is going to invade Taiwan while the West is, you know, seemingly allowing, you know, these incursions to happen. Is that your interpretation of China's intent?
So, you know, I think we need to focus on what we know. And the Chinese have actually gone a little bit further in terms of laying the foundation, laying the legal, international legal foundation for any action they take against Taiwan, I believe. You know, they have not only supported, you know, that may be too strong a word, let's say they haven't voted against Russia in the UN on these resolutions. They have supported Russia's concerns about what was happening with Ukraine, NATO, but they actually have gone a little bit further in terms of laying the legal groundwork for action that what they would take in terms of Taiwan, in that they have made it very clear from the very beginning that Taiwan is different from Ukraine, that Ukraine is because China does have this longstanding policy supporting sovereignty, and that's from self-interest, but it also has stated that sovereign nations shouldn't, you know, have the right to be sovereign nations, making the point very clear that Taiwan is not like Ukraine because Taiwan is not a sovereign nation. Taiwan is part of one China. It doesn't have a seat in the UN. It almost opens, they're actually laying a legal case for action that they might consider in Taiwan, whether that's by force or other means in terms of incorporating Taiwan more directly into China.
So will China take over Taiwan, you know, either militarily or otherwise?
I think over time, without putting a timeline on it, the answer is yes. That is the strategic goal of China, incorporating Taiwan, one China, and eventually resolving this issue. This is a strategic goal. And, you know, Xi Jinping has been very transparent in this, you know, in the fact that this is the objective of China. And he just said in November of 2021 in his meeting with President Biden that China had patience and it would strive for the peaceful reunification of Taiwan, but then cautioned that if the separatist forces in Taiwan provoke China and what he called was force our hands or even cross the red line, we'd be compelled to take resolute measures. He didn't explain what the Chinese red line was, but you know, he laid out a scenario that, you know, we will strive for peaceful. He's always talked about reunification. He says that their goal is peaceful reunification. So he's never said that reunification is not his goal. They're very clear that reunification is the goal. He said they have the patience to do it peacefully, but if pressed by the Taiwan independence and separatist efforts, you know, they might be compelled to take what he called resolute measures.
Right, and so Taiwan, you know, if Taiwan did it peacefully and wanted to join up and become officially part of China, they would do it. Except Taiwan has said not only no thank you, but No, absolutely not. We're not going to do it. And so then the question is, well, how patient will they be for how long? One of the major pieces of trade or commercial concern with Taiwan, of course, is semiconductor production. Most of the world's semiconductors are made in Taiwan, and about 90% of the most advanced semiconductors are made in Taiwan. So if there was a Chinese takeover, peaceful or otherwise, the world's semiconductor supply would be threatened. And it takes many years to build one of these plants and tens of billions of dollars. I mean, this is not something you can just easily move. So the West and the rest of the world is at risk here as a result of this, right?
Definitely. It is a definite vulnerability to the global economy. Taiwan is the major producer, not only of semiconductors, but of advanced semiconductors. And I believe about 90% of the advanced semiconductors come out of Taiwan. And so absolutely critical to the business community, the global business community, absolutely critical to the U.S. And, will have a major, major impact on the global economy. What's interesting about this is Taiwan has basically seen the semiconductor industry as their defense, that it's so important that it would to the Chinese as well, as I said, globally, that it's such an important industry that's what really would provide defense for them. That's a protecting defensive measure that they would not be invaded because of this. And I actually think the dynamic has shifted with the sanctions, and the against Russia, well, and also against China with Huawei. But we've seen the foreign direct product rule that President Trump used against Huawei actually stopped any technology that had U.S.-sourced components to it from being used, being used by Huawei. And it actually caused the collapse of Huawei almost immediately. That same foreign direct product rule is part of the Russia sanctions. And it's one of the most important sanctions in there because it did have such a debilitating effect on Huawei. And I think for Russia looking at that and China knowing that, semiconductors are absolutely critical. China is not producing yet the advanced semiconductors. They announced a 14-year plan for their 14th five-year plan about a year ago, where semiconductors are one of the key technologies that they're focusing on to produce, but they can't, and particularly advanced semiconductors, but they can't do that right now. There's a couple of years out. And so if you are being cut off from these semiconductors, in terms of trade, all of a sudden, I think that puts a more of a focus on the need to reunify, to use Chinese language, with Taiwan and incorporate Taiwan into China.
Yeah, so that's the rationale from a China standpoint, and that's why you think there's better than even odds that there will be some sort of action here. And it also says on the flip side that the rest of the globe's companies and who are reliant on all these semiconductors should really be considering other options and diversifying their supply chain, which is not a cheap or a quick thing to do, but it would seem before they find themselves with a black swan situation, they should begin to deal with that.
Right. And, what's really important, I was saying, what do we know? We know that reunification is a strategic goal that Xi Jinping has personally identified his leadership with. I mean, it's been a strategic goal of China, but he has personally identified with it. He's got a national congress coming up where he wants to get elected for his third or for life term, breaking out of the two-term limits. Everything I think is focused on that. I think that's going to be the consideration in terms of what he does and how he does it and what's needed. And so far, he's not having a very good year with the zero COVID policy, with the having an impact even further on China's growth. They're going to have the lowest growth year projection and not even sure if they could do that. I think it's about over 5% for growth, very low projection for China, but so it's bad to begin with, and whether they can even make that is an issue. He's looking towards the National Congress. Where does Taiwan fit into this? They are, they have to balance, and he's gonna be very careful about what he does, particularly over this year. It's an election year for him. But he also has to show success. And so, what do we know? How are they? They've been, most of their military exercises have been signaling to Taiwan that they are planning an invasion of Taiwan. That's what most of their military exercises have been doing. Part of that is, as I said, signaling, but it's also preparation. Where does the semiconductor piece of this fit in terms of their own economy and being able to move forward because of these sanctions? How important is that? And then also, watching what happens in Ukraine on the other side of the ledger, but also having to deal with any humiliation that may come out of Taiwan in terms of making Xi Jinping during this election year look weaker than he needs to look right now.
Very interesting commentary. Lori Esposito Murray, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Steve. Really appreciate it.
And thanks to all of you for listening into CEO Perspectives. Every week I'll be joined by a prominent expert to provide insights into the issues of our time. We'll cover leading topics in geopolitics, economics, public policy, ESG, human capital, marketing and communications, and more. Please share CEO Perspectives with all of your colleagues around the world. I'm Steve Odland, and this series has been brought to you by the Conference Board.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Conference Board, your source of trusted insights for what's ahead. For the latest insights to help guide your business through this time of geopolitical unrest, we have daily and relevant updates on our website at conference-board.org.